The opinions and views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of this panel broadcasting radio station. Welcome to Building the Future, a paid presentation of the Orange County IDA, Industrial Development Agency.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Building the Future. I'm your host, Bill Fioravanti, CEO of the Orange County IDA, or the Orange County Industrial Development Agency. Thanks for joining us again. I'm really excited about today's guest, a friend and colleague of mine, Colleen Hughes. Colleen, welcome. How are you, Colleen?
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Colleen is the founder of Coco Creative, so essentially a business development consultant firm with a specialization, no question about it, in cannabis and related to the related businesses there. So thanks for joining us, Colleen. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
I'm excited to talk about this because you are not just to me, you have been for a while for me, but you are in Orange County, you are the go-to person on this subject, frankly. You are. I know the county executive has consulted with you. Our economic development agencies have talked to you. I've certainly had you in plenty of meetings and collaborated on other things. So before we get into kind of talking about the New York cannabis market, which is interesting and constantly evolving, let's first talk about your place in it. Tell us, like, what's your story in terms of how you got involved in this and what are you doing now? Just to right off the top, I want people to understand what your role is in this professionally,
sure.
Really.
Thanks. Yeah, a little bit of background. I guess I could start with my relationship to the plant,
okay,
which started around high school, like most people experimenting.
Right.
And I think that, you know, my first time trying cannabis, sorry, mom and dad, if you're listening, but was in high school. I was at a friend's house and I remember not feeling any effects from it the first time I tried it.
Sure.
And I just remember thinking, like, what is the big deal about? Why are people acting like this is the scariest thing happening? So it really started that free thinking that a lot of people don't want you to express, right? So, and, you know, as a teenager questioning things, going from public school to Catholic school and having all kinds of questions, like, this was something that got me really fired up. Like, what's the fuss about? Like, nothing happened. I don't understand. And so I became very curious about it. And I read Jack Herrera's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, which outlines the history of hemp farming, hemp in America.
You told me about this book now. You read it that long ago?
Yeah, in the 90s. I have an autographed copy of the book. It's like yellow and stained from, you know, years of wear and tear.
Excellent. Okay.
But it is a huge resource. And I still, you know, when I guest lecture some college courses that are doing cannabis curriculum nowadays, that's like required reading that I always recommend people take.
A lot of that stuff debunked, you know, as the science came in, or is it
stands,
proven to be
yeah,
true?
Yeah, it still stands. And, you know, to not belabor the point, but Jack Herrera always said, like, this plant can save the world, and it's such a huge claim. But when you really dig into it and you see how regenerative a crop cannabis can be, it can clean brown fields, it can restore soil, it can remove impurities like heavy metals. And then you can use that crop to make rubber tires or textiles, or, you know, all, so it's really
construction building blocks,
construction,
you know, almost concrete blocks out of hemp. I've seen that.
So, you know, not only is there a health application for cannabis to be used as medicine and natural plant medicine, or, you know, for social lubrication, just like, you know, beer or wine is to most of the world, cannabis is a tool that you can put in your toolkit for healing and for fun, and also for regenerative farming and literally making almost any kind of material that you could think of. And why was this plant made illegal in the first place?
So let's tackle that, right?
Yeah.
Because to me, that's one of the things, especially when people want to debate it now, especially me being in, I'm not in the cannabis business, but, you know, we're involved in it's real economic development. It's an emerging sector.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in it. But a lot of people just have a stigma around it. And I had an argument with a guy who started a brewery once, and he said, oh, I'm just way against cannabis. I said, you manufacture your alcohol,
yeah, exactly.
And you're telling me that cannabis is so I just don't understand that. So how did it become illegal? Just so we understand a little bit about the plant too.
Well, back in the 90s, so we're going back to Henry Anslinger, where they created this like Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and this is back in like Billie Holiday era, jazz musicians and things like that. This guy Harry Anslinger basically just led this charge against drugs, you know. And I had read a book called Chasing the Scream. The author's name is escaping me now, but he had done this whole look at Harry Anslinger's life and how he had this traumatic experience because his mom was I think, addicted to opioids or something like that, where he had like a childhood trauma tied to this crusade of his. So he basically made it his life's mission to shut down, you know, drug trafficking. And it really became a racial thing at that point. And so they started weaponizing cannabis against communities of color. And that's really where the stigma started. And then the movie Reefer Madness, and then the Nixon administration, they did a study where, you know, we know that Richard Nixon's got hours and hours on tape that he was recorded saying all kinds of salacious things and horribly prejudiced comments, that he's been caught on tape saying things, where he wanted this study that they commissioned to find some fault in cannabis and how dangerous it is. And the study concluded that there really is, it's not as dangerous as people want it to be.
Sure.
And they buried the commission. So there's all of this sort of peacocking on the elected official side of things,
right,
because it is a tool that's been used to weaponize people against each other and sow division and things like that. So it really became a racial issue around that time, is really when it kind of came to the forefront. And so making cannabis and hemp illegal around the country, and then the world kind of followed suit after us. So it became, yeah, and I mean, cannabis grows naturally all over, like 80% of the world where crops can grow. Like,
wow.
Cannabis is found almost anywhere, and so many different cultures have used this as part of their pharmacopoeia to kind of treat you know, aches and pains, cramps, neurological issues. You know, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not saying this is going to cure anyone's ailments. I'm very careful about saying stuff like that.
Sure.
Especially having worked in the medical side of things. But, you know, it's been used for millennia to treat things, to treat all kinds of conditions. And so I think that it becomes about money. It becomes about one race being better than another race. You know, I hate to say things like that, but it really, we're seeing kind of the pendulum swinging the other way, where the cannabis legalization movement has become more of a way for communities of color who've been criminalized for selling weed or smoking pot,
sure,
or whatever, where they've been put in jail for things where their white counterparts are using at the same rates as people of color, but people of color are you know, arrested at higher rates, they're incarcerated at higher rates,
mm-hmm,
and that
more severe punishments,
and
yeah,
that leads to a whole lot of societal and socioeconomic issues for single parent families, and you know, all of the things that kind of come from that incarceration of a parent and policing of black and brown communities far more than their suburban white counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start digging into the data, and we can get to this, you know, later in our conversation, we're talking about like the state of affairs and the adult use market, but that kind of, people get really uncomfortable when you talk about race. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, I find as a white woman in the space, trying to be an advocate and an ally for people of color to be able to have all the opportunities that have been afforded their white counterparts,
mm-hmm,
having these conversations with white people, or my white colleagues, you know, behind closed doors, a lot of people are very dismissive of the racial component, mm-hmm, of federal legalization.
Right.
And so when you see this is like broken down into states' rights, and so every state is kind of doing it their own way,
yep,
but it's all very restrictive.
Well, you have the federal classification. So you talked about,
right,
the kind of the prohibition and the history of that. Now let's fast forward to what's happening now in the Biden,
yep,
administration trying to really make that an issue. Can you talk about what's happening with that?
Yeah, I mean, I would like the Biden administration to make good on their promises.
Right.
They did start doing some pardons and some expungements and things like
is it they asked the FDA to take a look at reclassifying?
The DEA, the FDA, I mean, it's, what we want is to really deschedule cannabis and not reschedule it as
Can
a Schedule 3.
Our listeners understand what that means exactly, because it's huge ramifications, especially,
yeah,
including how the cannabis industry works and doesn't work in New York State as,
yes,
a result.
So Schedule 1 drug is high potential for abuse and little to no medicinal value. So heroin is a Schedule 1 narcotic.
Mm-hmm.
Cannabis is classified in the same schedule as heroin.
Wow.
and descheduling it to three. I think cocaine is a schedule three, where there is some medical application and there's still a high potential for abuse with cocaine.
Sure. Cocaine is prescribed to...
I think it's used as like an anesthetized thing, you know, like Novocaine, cocaine. You know, I don't know any dentists that are using that material for that purpose, but I mean, it is classified, but it's still an illegal substance for any normal person to have. But so we would like to have it removed completely from the schedule because it is a plant, right? Okay. Like descheduled. And then also with that, you have the federal illegality of it. So we're finally starting to see like institutions, learning institutions that were getting federal funding, having cannabis curriculum in their college courses, mm-hmm. where if you were eligible for federal funding, you wouldn't be able to have a cannabis course because you wouldn't get that funding anymore. So there's been some workarounds with cannabis as education, which I think is so important, especially on the medical side. And then you have like accounting 280E, where you have a federally illegal substance. So when you're working in a state that's got legal, medical, or adult use, there's certain things that you can't write off on your taxes like a normal business would, like building materials or any kind of plant touching stuff. Is you can't write off those same things as expenses. So it becomes a lot more challenging to operate as an owner operator because you're trying to navigate all these really wacky accounting rules. Sure. And a lot of CPAs don't necessarily specialize in that. So now you have all these niche markets opening up where you have attorneys that specialize only in cannabis, and you have CPAs that specialize in 280E and for cannabis businesses. So that's what's pretty cool coming out of all of this, like the states turning over legalization, is that there's all these little niche markets kind of popping up and ancillary industry support aside from plant touching businesses. So you have the 280E, which is a challenge to navigate. New York decided to like uncouple that. So we are going to see people starting to write those things off in New York because they decided to take their own tack with this, which is great. Leaps and bounds ahead of some other states.
For state returns, state tax returns.
Yeah, right. So that's kind of the big fork in the road between like federal and local state.
And one other aspect of that I want to touch on that I don't think a lot of people realize, it's a cash business for the most part, right? Because of this Schedule One classification federally.
Yeah.
Banks don't want to touch it oftentimes.
Yeah,
it's such a major amounts of cash going in some of these huge businesses in the sector.
Historically, it has been cash only. And I think you might remember, I think 60 Minutes might have done a special when Colorado had become legal, and they were showing how people had duffel bags of cash that they had to bring to the bank and they were getting robbed. You know, we don't really see so much of that anymore on the East Coast because there are providers, software providers that are doing payment processing. So they are using like a cashless ATM model. So you can go in with your debit card. You can go in and like use the ATM. That most dispensaries have an ATM machine. Mm-hmm. Some of them take debit cards. Where they're doing a cashless ATM transaction. So you'll get, let's say you're buying $68 worth of something. They round it up to 70 as like an even number for your ATM transaction. So it to me is a loophole, and I'm not a finance expert, so I can't comment on how slippery that slope might be. But there are...
So they're finding workarounds, these dispensaries and such. Okay.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't see them carrying duffel bags of cash.
Right.
And you know, I do know that a lot, basically all of the dispensaries that I've been to in person have a security guard, you know, on site all the time whenever there's people in the business. And we had a conversation yesterday with a security guard in the city. I was in the city visiting a couple dispensaries with some clients, and one of the security guards were asking him about, do you have armed security? Because up here, one of the dispensaries has an armed guard in it. Mm. And, you know, in the city, you're not allowed to have weapons. So there's all these little things where it's like, it costs a lot more to have an armed security guard.
Interesting.
And what kind of value does that provide? Are people going to be put off by the fact there's someone standing at the door with a gun? Wow. Or do you want to have a more hospitable environment and sort of mitigate people's fears and the stigma associated with coming to a dispensary in the first place? Because a lot of people, especially in Orange County, have never had the experience to walk into a legal dispensary to just ask questions, you know? So it could be intimidating if there's, you know, some big dude at the door, you know, strapped. So it's like, but we're seeing, you know, we're seeing everyone's kind of doing their own thing, and every kind of store has their own vibe and their own sort of feel to it. So some may call for an armed guard.
But let's pull back here for a second and talk about the state of the industry in New York State right now. First of all, on the medical side, in my experience with it going back, and you were involved, I recall, with a couple of the projects, the New York State passed the Compassionate Care Act, which was legalized medical cannabis. Did they have a cannabis board at that time?
No. So the Compassionate Care Act, I think, was passed, I want to say, like 2016.
It was like 20, right around there.
And that was under the auspice of the Department of Health. So the DOH ended up creating an office, and kind of looking back now, I think it was hard for operators to navigate the system, and it felt very strict, like overly restrictive in a lot of ways with just the regulations and things we had to do, like as an operator. But looking back, it was like I actually give a round of applause to the Department of Health. And I know, I think Nicole Quackenbush had come over from the Department of Health to the OCM to help with a lot of
Office of Cannabis Management.
Office of Cannabis Management. Yeah. So you have two entities in New York now. So before it was the DOH, Department of Health was overseeing all of the medical cannabis programs. Right. So they awarded five licenses in the first round, and the medical operators were required to be vertically integrated. And that's to say you can grow your own cannabis, process your own cannabis into like
vape pens, pre-rolled
tinctures. And at that time we didn't have flower, so we couldn't have pre-rolls.
Oh, right.
So I the
forgot.
First,
it was no flower for
so
a
we've
while.
Gone through a lot of iterations so far. Yep. So it we have made a lot of progress. So, but it was very stringent. Like there was a lot of stringent rules and regulations. And when I started working for one of the operators, I quickly realized like there's a huge learning curve here for a lot of people who are probably going to try to transition from the legacy market or the, you know, what people refer to as the black market. We call it the traditional or the legacy market now. There's going to be a big learning curve for people that have a book of business out on the street and, you know, are probably doing really good business for themselves. But to come into a regulated environment is a completely different world, and all the different steps you have to take to make sure you're compliant with the state. You know, I remember the one of the products we were making tested positive for lead, and you know, they had to dump out like $40,000 worth of tincture because one of the rubber plunger on a tincture bottle, like the little squeeze bubble, like those had lead in them, and it contaminated the tincture inside. So it was the packaging that was bad, not the cannabis. Huh. And so it ended up testing positive for lead. So those products were tested before they were allowed on the market. So it was like a precautionary measure. They do randomized lots and they pick random samples, and then they go to the lab and get tested by a third party. At the time, the state was doing the testing for all the medical companies. And then they would clear a batch to be put on the shelves for sale. So there was a lot of safeguards in place with the DOH because they're thinking about this as like a public health and safety issue. And like these are all the measures that people had to go through.
So, and these are some of the benefits that you want testing. You want to know what the product is.
Yes.
You want to know what the dosages are, right? I mean, I've heard you talk about that so much. People that are cooking things with marijuana, they don't know what they're doing with that.
Right.
They don't know how much they're taking. That's why they have these episodes. But it's very scientific and it's very simple process where they can, perfect your dosages and people being aware of what's in them and everything.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so kind of like what I mentioned before about hemp being used to clear out brownfields, and it's called what's called a bioaccumulator. So it actually pulls impurities out of the soil. So that'll happen on the industrial hemp side. It'll happen in a cannabis grow that's indoors. So if you put a banned pesticide on your plant, for example, the plant is going to pull that poison into its system, and then you could be smoking harmful pesticides without knowing. And so that's one of the issues you're seeing with like the cartels, you know, out west and Humboldt, like they're robbing farmers and then they're using these banned chemicals that you can get in Mexico but you can't get here, and then they're flooding the market with potentially tainted or unsafe cannabis. So there's so many factors to think about, honestly. But so after they awarded the first five licenses,
which we got two, by the way, in Orange County, we had Pharmacan in the Montgomery Hamptonburg area, and Sativa in Warwick. And then one was awarded to outside our area in Fulton, is it Montgomery County there? Schenectady, they had Fiorello, and we actually stole them and brought them over, attracted them to what we were doing in Warwick at the former prison site.
Right.
And GTI, Green Thumb Industries, with the Fiorello was the name of their license was under. They just built a 450,000 square foot cultivation processing center right there in Warwick. So we've got three medical producers.
Yes.
So, which is exciting. As you said, the five. Now let's talk about the rec side, the adult use.
Right. Well, so after the first five, there was a second five allowed. So GTI was part of the second five, I believe. Well, Fiorello was part of the first five.
I think they were installed. That's why I used to say the second, but I think it was the first, and we stole it during the second.
There's been so many mergers and acquisitions in this. Like, I do a guest lecture for a few college courses, and one of them is corporate cannabis and multi-state operators. So that's fun. You should see my slide deck for that. It's like how many times this one company's been bought or sold or, you know, borrowed or whatever.
Well, there's a lot of that now I'm noticing in the industry, right? You have investment banks, you have, you know, venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. They're all getting into this space, obviously, because there's huge dollars, especially now that the recreational market's about to blow up.
Yeah. So the 10 are vertically integrated, which, and the reason why I'm like not letting us go beyond this is because it's important to know about the vertical integration, because the medical companies were forced into vertical integration, basically saying you're going to be the big guys. We're only going to let 10 operate, and you have to be vertically integrated so you can grow, process, and sell your own products.
Seed to sale, exactly.
Yep. And then they're allowed to wholesale each other's products. So like if you go into PharmaCann's dispensary, you'll find Sativa's products there or vice versa.
Why are they doing that? Just for diversification?
And more opportunity. And so now part of the adult use legislation or the regulations are that the big RO, so there's so many acronyms. So the ROs are the registered organizations. Mm-hmm. Those are the medical companies, the 10.
The vertical companies.
The 10 vertically integrated medical operators are called registered organizations. They have to devote 40% of their shelf space to like social equity or small mom and pop growers and farmers. So now we're diversifying the medical market even more with on the adult use side, which allowing all these other producers to be in those stores.
Now, how are they getting licenses, those growers, the small ones and such?
So that's part of the work that I do as a consultant. Navigating the regulatory process has been, pretty arduous. You know, we're all very tired. We were working on this during the Compassionate Care Act and then the CRTA, which was the Cannabis Regulation and Tax Act. We called that the Cuomo bill. Former Governor Cuomo was not very friendly to cannabis and was going to be a big corporate cannabis bill. And so we really fought in earnest against that model. We wanted to see more opportunities for small businesses and have a more diverse market because we studied what happened in Colorado and what happened in California and how you had this proliferation of the gray market. So the legislation in New York, which is called the Marijuana Regulation and Tax Act, was passed in 2021 after we had the 10 medical operators on board to expand. They would be able to expand their medical operations by adding a couple co-located adult use dispensaries on their medical portfolio. And then regular mom and pop folks or people who were growing underground, we were trying to incentivize everybody to kind of come onto the legal side so that there were more opportunities for people to get into the legal market. And so what we've seen now is the first round of applications were called the conditional adult use retail dispensary licenses. And those were earmarked for folks that had cannabis convictions who could also demonstrate an aptitude for business showing 2 years of profits in a legitimate business enterprise coupled with this cannabis conviction.
Okay.
So it was like, I'm looking for needles in a haystack, but there were a lot of folks that qualified for that. And the state said they were going to award 150 of those conditional retail dispensary licenses. After the application window closed, they opened that up. So it was no longer 150. They've awarded, I think, 468 of those licenses. The problem has been that as with any new rollout in industry, there's people and their lawyers who are suing the state for any kind of reason. So there was an injunction, a temporary restraining order placed against the CARD program. That's what we call the acronym C, Conditional Adult Use Retail Dispensary. We call it the CARD dispensary. So you out of 468 conditional adult use retail dispensary licensees, they've been given provisional licenses, and now they're trying to find locations in which to set up shop. The problem is the injunction stopped the state from processing any more applications. So that took, you know, 6 to 8 months of like no progress until that injunction was kind of thrown out. And then you have, at the municipal level, you have municipalities were able to either opt in to allow legal cannabis retail or opt out of legal cannabis retail. And you'll see if you look across the state, about half, maybe a little more than half of the municipalities covering the state decided to opt out.
I think in Newburgh, it was all but, I'm sorry, in Orange County, it was all but two, I want to say, or something. City of Newburgh and something random like Woodbury or Harriman.
Woodbury, Wayweyanda, Newburgh. I mean, I think they had until December 31st, 2 years ago, to make that decision.
Right.
Long Island is completely forbidden. There's only like two. Yeah, there's only like two or three townships that are allowing it.
And I've spoken to local mayors and supervisors about it. And again, it's not a personal thing with pot. It is just I see this as an industry.
It's
and
an opportunity.
It is legal. It's just like you're allowed to sell alcohol.
Yep.
So and I see the job creation opportunities, the multiplier, the spillover effect here. And it's not. It reminds me also about the casino discussion.
Mm-hmm,
when we were in the casino craze, everyone would say in a public hearing, oh, you're going to have prostitutes, you're going to have drug runners and all these things. You don't see that. What the unfortunate part you see with casinos are you're seeing, you know, working class people spending a lot
losing
of their money
their
there.
Money.
That's that's really,
right.
to me, the worst part of it.
But
that's not all of it, no question about
it.
But, you know, same thing here. So this is, these are real jobs, real pay. So I just think they're kind of missing
and
the boat there.
One thing in your next conversation with an elected official, depending on the municipality that they're located in, it would be fair to say, and we did this experiment. We had some farmers and myself. There is a cultivation facility in Montgomery, and we invited some elected officials and some law enforcement officials to come and tour a legal cultivation facility and just to see how a legal operation operates.
Right.
You know, how clean everything is, how orderly it is. It's like you wouldn't even know that, aside from the smell, you wouldn't know.
That's
that
what
they
gives
were,
it away.
You wouldn't know that they were, you know, making pre-rolls. It's just like they're making widgets. You know, it's really just a normal operation with staff and break time and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we gave them a tour and, you know, some of them were making little jokes here and there. And that kind of gets under my skin because it's like we work so hard to try to move this needle and create these opportunities for legalization.
It's just one of those things that people are always have a joke about. It comes at my board meetings, whatever. Everyone's got a high joke, something, you know, it's just one of those things.
And so going through that tour and just like you can see the gears working, like where you're demystifying something, you're destigmatizing at the same time. And then at the end of the tour, one of the farmers pulled out of his pocket three packages of cannabis that he bought illegally at the gas station and the deli's right around the corner from the legal grow operation. And so one of them was like an orange prescription bottle that just had a P-Touch label that said like gelato or one of the strain names on it. No warning label, no child protection, no nothing. So you have the right around the corner in a municipality that's opted out of legal retail. You have kids going into gas stations and buying this weed from under the counter.
Who knows where?
Totally unchecked.
Jeez. Plus, and you have some of this. What's the word I want to use? It's not natural. It's
synthetic.
Synthetic, right? You have synthetic. What is it? Delta.
There's
six,
Delta eight. Yeah. So there's all the deltas, and that's like a whole other conversation for another day.
No,
probably,
but it's just that's where it's another danger zone there, especially for younger people. They don't realize what's in there. Whereas trying to do it organized through the state regulations, testing, all of that. That's what ensures the safety.
And
which is
a
number
place
one.
For people to go in their own community to buy legal tested cannabis,
right.
Because not only are we dealing with the children that are going to a gas station to buy illegal, untested, whatever, and then you see on the news cannabis overdose.
Right.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but it's not a cannabis overdose. It's a chemical that's in this product that made somebody sick. People don't die from cannabis, right? So there's so many like issues about that. So when I like to speak to elected officials about this. It's like creating a place for people to have sovereignty over their decisions and what they put in their bodies and have access to safe, legal tested cannabis. Because without those options, the illicit market just keeps thriving and nobody's capturing those tax dollars, right? So you have all of this money being spent on pseudo weed from the gas station, or, you know, you have smoke shops popping up everywhere and they say like they're selling cigars, vapes, CBD and much more. You know, you're getting advertisements for that. You can't advertise for legal cannabis. So you, like, there's so many, you know, roadblocks for the legal business because of FCC regulations and, you know, all of those things that make
it harder. I never heard that about advertising as
Wow. Make it harder for illegal operators. Yeah. And then you have just people running rampant selling.
Let's talk for a moment about those, because I see them. I see them in the streets of Newburgh. Mm-hmm. I see them all over the county, frankly, these illegal shops. But the police don't seem to be able to enforce them. Is, is that what it is? Enforce the law to shut them down? Do you know what the issue, the loophole they're using?
So they are, there for sure is a loophole. It's illegal for somebody to sell unlicensed cannabis.
Okay.
So they're definitely breaking a law there. But what happened was when we passed the MRTA, the adult use law, it decriminalized possession of cannabis. So that created a loophole for people to have a certain amount of weight, so up to 3 ounces.
3 ounces is the amount.
That they could have it in their store and just kind of sell it under the table. And what would they really be getting in trouble? Like, you know, the, there's no fines, there's no not like, so now they're starting to kind of tighten that up because the adult use market is just now launching. Now we have about 75, I think, legal cannabis dispensaries throughout the state. But they're trying to compete with illicit shops that are all over the place. So like in the legislation now, or in the regulations now, you cannot operate 2 legal dispensaries within 1,000 feet of each other. But in that 1,000 feet, there's like 5 or 6 illegal shops.
Right.
So, and the people are just going because they, the illegal shops are using neon signs, cartoon characters, you know, all the things that are banned from the legal side of things, like Cookie Monster and like all these different like cartoon, like Sour Patch Kids that market to children. Like it's all this like knockoff packaging that kids are going in and buying stuff. They're not checking ID. They're not, you know, so it's, that's kind of a muddy water. And I think that, you know, I've heard unofficially that some of the DAs don't really want to waste time and resources prosecuting these like unlicensed shops because of, they could be fighting for, you know, people who've been murdered and, you know, because of other serious cases that need the bandwidth of law enforcement. And so now there's been some bills. There was a task force that was put together. Senator Cooney like started this task force to kind of question the Office of Cannabis Management, like what's going on with this. And like they kind of took the power away from law enforcement because of the over policing of black and brown communities. They didn't want to like recriminalize people all over again. So it's this delicate line of letting the illicit shops stay in operation versus recriminalizing people. And so they've been trying to incentivize the illegal shops to become legitimate. If you get caught with an illicit shop, you won't ever get a legal license. But they're just, you know, they've got hundreds of pounds of weed and they get fined, they close their doors, everything gets seized, and then 2 days later they're open up again. You know, they have more money than the state, and the state's gonna spend how many tens of thousands of dollars just to do a raid, and then they're open 2 days later. So it's like, where the, you know, it's like a waste of resources. So
I'd like to get into the social justice aspect of New York State's law with that. But first of all, I want to ask you back to kind of the economics of it. What are the job opportunities that are in this sector, really? What kinds of jobs? Help people understand what kind of work there is, what they're doing in that space, and what kind of pay you're seeing. Just help us understand the quality of those jobs.
So there's a plethora of opportunities for the workforce here. You have plant touching opportunities, and then you have ancillary industry opportunities. So a plant-touching opportunity would be working for one of the medical companies or one of the new license holders as a cultivator or a bud tender. So you have some entry-level jobs that are paying around $20-something dollars an hour, where, you know, essentially like the equivalent of like a wine shop, like going in and asking the clerk, like, I'm going to have pot roast tonight. What do you recommend? It's like the same kind of thing. You would go in and say, you know, I'm having trouble sleeping. What would you recommend? And so the bud tender or in the medical side, we call them patient care representatives. They would, you know, make a recommendation based on the person's needs. And on the medical side, you have a pharmacist that's required to be in all the medical dispensaries. The adult use dispensaries are not medical dispensaries, so they're not allowed to give medical advice. And that's, again, another thing I kind of harp on all the time, is that we're not doctors, and we can't tell somebody who's looking for something to help them go to sleep, if you don't know that they're on heart medication or something else, like, you, bud tenders can't give medical advice. So it's like, you know, usually you see the young ones say, well, this works for me and this helps me, knocks me right out. But like, you have an older woman who's got on heart medication or something that might not work well for her. So it's a lot of it's trial and error. So when people have real health conditions, I suggest they talk to their healthcare provider and go through the medical route. That way they have real hand holding with product selection. But as far as other job opportunities, you have, you know, managerial jobs, running a dispensary, running cultivation facilities, running, you know, HR. You have processing, where people who have a knack for chemistry or have background in, you know, biology or chemistry can get into the cultivation and processing side.
Do pay scales start to go up a little
bit? Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Those are more specialized. But the entry level, you know, you have packaging folks, like people who are going to make the pre-rolls, people who are doing formulations. Like, a lot of those things you can be taught on the job if you have an aptitude for those things. Like, if you're not very good at math or thinking on the fly with fractions and things like that, or like if you can't follow a recipe, then I wouldn't suggest that be your field. And then on the retail side, a lot of it is like bud tending. If you're not a public facing person and you kind of like to do numbers, there's fulfillment. So like behind the scenes in the back of a dispensary, when you go in and place your order, someone's got to pull that product, put it in a bag, double check it, make sure it's right, and then pass it off to the front. So fulfillment is another thing. There's security jobs, so that you need security in almost every place. There's a lot of tech work, you know, building websites, apps, social media, marketing, you know, merchandising, you know, all of that. There's, so it's basically, I like to say that cannabis is like very intersectional. Like, whatever it is that you're doing in your job currently could probably be done in some way, shape, or form intersectionally with cannabis in the industry. So accounting, bookkeeping, you know, finance, compliance. Compliance is a big deal. That's also very specialized, but it's, you know, following standard operating procedures and setting up standard operating procedures. Finance, you know, there's always number crunching that needs to happen and bottom line improving, things like that. And then the ancillary opportunities, like I was saying, like social media, website. The interesting thing with how the adult use stuff is shaking out is that they're modeling it after kind of the alcohol industry, like a two-tier system. So if you're a grower, you're not able to also be a retailer. So they're separating those buckets of the supply chain to kind of try to keep everybody honest. So we're seeing, like, it's people get real creative. Once the law comes out, then you see people trying to weasel around the law. And that's really to kind of protect out-of-state operators, like, you know, big brands that are kind of well-known in California trying to get into the New York market, doing all kinds of weaselly things to get their products on the shelf. And so what's important to note for your listeners is that in New York, the cannabis that you buy is grown in New York. It's not shipped in from California. It's not brought in, you know.
As a rule, it's all grown in New York, sold in New York.
So it's, you're licensed growing in New York, and then you're selling to a licensed dispensary. So it's all New York grown. So you have genetics, and that's like a whole other conversation, but proprietary genetics that are belong to different grow houses out west. Now they're trying to find partners in New York where they can grow the same genetics and try to have the same sort of look, feel, and smell and effect that they have when they're growing indoor in California. So it's getting real interesting now to see those partnerships take shape and who's growing what where. And it's great. I mean, it is great to drive by somewhere and you kind of smell it. You're like,
yeah. It's, somebody sent me a picture of I think it was adult cannabis that they purchased, and they showed me the label. It said grown in Warwick, New York, and I took pride in that.
That's
a great. It's a made in Orange County product. It's wonderful. It's high quality. I mean, they're telling me just high what quality. I think the brand was what they call it, Rhythm or something. But it's on, you know, and it was it's made right here. So, you know, we see the value. Just to tell our story a little bit with the IDA, there's a former prison in Warwick. You know this well. Colleen. It was called the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility. And in 2010, Governor Cuomo announced that it was going to be closed, like so many other prisons around the state, trying to contract those and really save their budget for the most part. And the town supervisor for Warwick, Mr. Michael Sweet, and you know him well.
Shout out to Mike.
Yeah, he's not. I always give him credit because he didn't want to see that prison become just a blighted campus there.
It's a beautiful property.
It's gorgeous. It could have been overgrown, boarded up buildings and all of that. He came to the county. He came to the IDA and he said, I want to capitalize on it. I want to make this a business park. I really want to turn this, you know, into an economic driver for the town and make it an advantage rather than, again, a blight on the community. And I will say this is before my time, though I was involved, before my time in my position at the IDA. But the IDA had the foresight to realize that this was there was an opportunity there and this was a sector that we could kind of double down on. And the IDA invested about $3.5 million to convert parts of that campus to make it shovel ready so you could we could bring new attraction projects, new construction projects, namely GTI, Green Thumb.
Right.
Again, almost 500,000 square feet for cannabis operations. They built that. It wouldn't have been possible if the IDA didn't invest and make that property shovel ready in these pad sites. And then we converted. It's amazing. It used to be a dairy barn on site there. It used to be a, I can't remember if it's a chicken coop or a pig coop or something, pig pen. And the IDA funding converted into a laboratory like what you're talking about. Now Phytopharma is there doing testing for some of the other tenants on the campus.
And shout out to Urban Extracts.
Urban Extracts, absolutely. They're in the former dairy barn, which again, we helped renovate. It's an incredible space there. We've had a cannabis conference you were a part of course, a few months ago there with our friends at Upstate Capital and a couple other partners, Venture Hub out in New Paltz. And we had it upstairs in Urban Extracts, which they called Sweeten Hall,
by the way, after
Mike Sweeten, which is great. So it was great to see all that come. And they're doing CBD extraction, of course, and now they have a cultivation the license. So they're growing cannabis as well there.
And I can say their products are legitimate fire.
Really? Like,
that's what the kids are saying these
days. Good to hear.
But it's great. They have so many novel partnerships that they've been doing. And
they're terrific. Really, Aaron Sheeran, the head of Urban Extracts and his team, really
and
just
Steve
great.
And Jonathan,
just tremendous.
They're killing it.
So it's great to see what happened there. And by the way, because it was a former prison, this is us using our fund balance, kind of our savings, right, that we've accumulated from fees we charge companies that come to us for incentives. Well, we wanted to deploy that in something that would bring about new economic development, new opportunities and jobs in a sector, again, an emerging sector like cannabis. So we've really doubled down on that. Because it was a former prison site, there was an economic development grant tied to it.
Oh.
So the IDA put $3.5 million in. We got $3 million back.
Oh, that's
so for $500,000 of an investment in our savings, which is to me, I consider Orange County taxpayer money, we helped convert what could have been an overgrown blight on the community and made it just what Michael Sweeten's dream was.
Right.
It is an economic driver. It has the cannabis sector, certainly, I would say, is a cornerstone of that park. But you have
Drownlands
Brewery. Yep. You have Hudson Sports Complex. Yep. You have beautiful people with an adaptive sports field there. Just a tremendous diversity on that campus there. It's really, really great. And I just, yes, it's a shameless plug for the IDA, but we had the foresight to see that this was a sector we wanted to invest in, and we're seeing the fruits of it now.
Right.
We are the flower of it, as you're saying, right?
It's
great.
The flower of your labor.
So we're running out of time, but I do want to now come back to my initial question, which is, what's the role you're playing? How are you helping, especially small companies, I believe, that are really trying to find their way in this new market? How are you helping them, and what success are you having with that?
So thanks for the opportunity to give a little insight there.
Sure.
So for me, I do business development consulting. I help folks apply, navigate the regulatory process, apply for licensing. So I have a handful of clients that are now in the queue for review with the state, because the state's now starting to award new unconditional adult use licenses.
You help them put their application together, how to put their best foot forward with their plan and such?
Yeah, so a lot of the work that I do is, so people who want to become regulated in the legal industry, they need lawyers, they need accountants, they need some regulatory guidance, especially if people have been operating outside of the law for a while.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of my clients have history in the legacy market.
Okay.
So it is, like I said before, like bridging that learning curve for, doing something you've done for a long time and now doing it in a regulated environment. And then I do kind of like the pre-law and the pre-CPA, like organizational work for the clients. So I help them get all of their corporate filings, get all their documents together. I organize everything for them. And then I interface and kind of quarterback between the application process, dealing with elected officials, dealing with the municipalities on their behalf. And then when there is a need for an attorney to review something, rather than paying, you know, $5,000-$6,000 in attorney's fees to have an attorney do your business plan, like I'm doing that at a much lower rate. And so some of the attorneys that I work with really appreciate that I have the brain for that, and I can prepare the client for those conversations so the lawyers can come in, do what they're really good at, and not wasting time on doing like menial sort of administrative tasks.
You're saving them money then, making it much more cost effective in their approach.
For sure. And so I try to pool those resources where I have a handful of clients that might have the same issue, then I can kind of get them all ready, and then we do one conference call with everybody on it. So it's kind of like time saving, but it's also like kind of laying the runway, like kind of giving folks what to expect, you know, and in New York, it's expect the unexpected. We're very consistently inconsistent here
yes,
in New York.
That's for sure.
And there has been a lot of whiplash over the last 2 years in trying to get people open. So it is also like helping folks weather the storm of the regulatory process and the application process. And then once folks are awarded, I would be helping them with their operations, like getting their stuff set up, introducing them with vendors, you know, because I've been in the industry now over 10 years, I guess, now almost.
As long as it's been an industry, it seems
in New York
industry,
at least, that, you know, I have a lot of, I have a lot of really good relationships and a lot
I see you everywhere. Social media, conferences, speaker panels.
Yeah.
You are clearly a leader in this and a real strong voice in it.
Thanks.
And you are ours for Orange County, as I said at the top of the show. I mean, you really are our local expert. We appreciate it. You've educated a lot of us. You've educated our listeners here. Last piece, we have less than 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
The other piece, we kind of touched, dance around a little bit, but New York is trying to really have a social justice component to it. As you said, people that have been impacted by the laws, the cannabis law, when they were prohibited, the laws, and really were hurt by it disproportionately, you know, some races and ethnic groups as opposed to others. There's a social justice workforce component piece. I still see it being kind of flaky. I'm not really seeing the meat in it.
Yeah.
You've developed something, and I believe you called it trainee, trying to help be, you know, a solution to that. Can you just talk about that before we wrap?
Sure, thanks. The trainee partnership was kind of coined as the HEART program back in the day, and it was an acronym, Healing, Education, Assistance, Reinvestment, and Training. So that kind of says what it is.
Okay.
But what's important to note is that 40% of all the cannabis tax revenue that's collected by the state is going to be put back into community reinvestment programming. So targeting impacted communities. So there's a term, CDI, communities disproportionately impacted, and that's based on Census and Justice Bureau data.
Okay.
So defined by, you know, impacted communities, that reinvestment money is going to go back into the communities that need it. So I wanted to help not only train, do workforce development, like healing, education, like components to get people ready for the workforce or for entrepreneurship, like in legal cannabis. But then on the back end, taking those tax dollars and making sure that everyone that's participating in these programs, like, gets the reinvestment component to come back to their communities. So the people who are doing the work in those communities would partner with my organization. So then, like, again, I do the pre-law, the pre-CPA stuff, and I do like all of the facilitating. And then when the money comes, then we divert it back to those communities or to those nonprofits that are doing the work out on the street. Right.
And I feel like those groups are going to need that help really to access those types of funds. So it's, it's critically important. Okay, Colleen, thank you so much for joining us. I think you've, like you do every time I'm in front of you, educate me, educate our listeners to this. How can, if people want to learn more, if they want to use your services, let's say if they, they want to get into this sector, how do they get a hold of you?
So email is probably the best way to get in touch with me. It's Colleen, C-O-L-L-E-E-N, at CocoCreativeNY.com.
Just like it sounds.
Just like it sounds.
C-O-C-O?
Yep, C-O-C-O.
Terrific. And you're on social media and such?
Yes, again, I am. I'm on Instagram at Colleen Marade, but I don't follow anybody back. So.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's all right. So are you going to be anywhere else at a conference or any speaking engagements coming up we could talk about?
Let me think about this. Well, we have the Cannabis Parade Day is May 4th, so I'll be down there for that. We have MJ.
Where's that?
That's in New York City, Union Square.
Great.
That's all day, an all day thing. That's really a good time. And then MJ Unpacked is in April. That'll be in Atlantic City. So that's for people who are looking to get into the space. You kind of have to be qualified to get into that conference. They don't just let anyone in. You have to have, like, be in the application process or have a facility or, you know, in the works.
Okay.
Yeah, and I do a lot of different advocacy work on different roundtables and national advocacy groups and things like that. So I'm always doing some kind of speaking thing.
Awesome. Really appreciate it. So Colleen at CocoCreativeNY.com.
You got it.
Terrific. Colleen Hughes, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
We really appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for joining us, too, for another episode of Building the Future. We could have called this one Growing the Future. Same idea. But thanks again. I'm your host, Bill Fioravanti, with the Orange County IDA. Please join us next time when we have another exciting guest like Colleen. So thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time, folks. Have a good day. Bye-bye.